Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Words That Works on Crown Talk and Drum Internet Radio Station. We are here to have a conversation today with assistant principal out of New York. It's in the New York school system, Dr. Renato Bauer, and she should be checking in soon. And also waiting for the other hosts to join us. Good evening, Doctor. How are you? Hello?
This is Cunningham here. I called in at first
I'm
and it
sorry.
Hung me up.
I'm sorry. She never changed her number from North Carolina. And hers is 704, and I looked up, and I just knew that was her. Well, welcome.
Okay.
Welcome, welcome. And words that work. It's not what you say. It's what the people hear and feel. I guess also we need to add to that. We need to understand the context that the words are spoken in so we will be able to get the true meaning of what is being said. A lot of times we don't think of the context that what we hear something or what we read when we read something, we just focus on what is written right there in that sentence. I found that once we start looking beyond the sentences or the words that's on that paper and put them in the social, cultural, economic, and sometimes political condition that writer or spokesman is using that language or making those statements, we get a better understanding of what that person is saying and where that person is at that particular time. Dr. Renato?
Yes, I'm here. Good evening.
All right. Good evening. We have Sister Cunningham, and who's on the line also. She's the co-host.
And good evening.
We like. We'd like to give the guest an opportunity to say a few words before we get started. I know I met you about before the pandemic, and you had a program on the radio station at one point in time, and you were here in North Carolina, teaching here in North Carolina, and you wound up going to New York, where you got your job as an assistant principal. Are you a principal now?
No, assistant principal.
No.
All right. And who is that? Is
no.
that one
yeah.
of the new bloggers?
No.
Yeah, the newest one, yeah.
No.
He's in the background, so I'm muting my mic so I don't interrupt anyone. But, yes, I'm happy to be on. Bishop Armstrong, I met you, I want to say 2017. That's a long time. I'm just happy to be on. I'm happy to be on and interested on the topic. So I'm here. And good evening, Ms. Cunningham. I'm excited to hear what's going on this evening.
Well, you're going to sort of tell us a little bit about what's happening in the education system. You were in the one here in North Carolina, I think Charlotte Mecklenburg, and now you're in one in New York. Compare and contrast the two.
Wow. All I can say is that, you know, working in North Carolina, I worked as a teacher, inclusion setting, from 2010 to I finished the 2019 school year. And, you know, I enjoyed because when I went, you know, a little background about me, I went to college in Buffalo State College. So I lived in Buffalo, had my family in Buffalo. So coming to North Carolina was just a breath of fresh air, nice weather, people were friendlier, school system, they had the busing. It's just a different atmosphere. Working in the capacity as a teacher, I was already intrinsically motivated to be a better educator than what I grew up with, you know, being more involved in my students, not just academically, but making sure that they're safe in school. Going to New York City, it was a shift. It's the same thing as far as me being an educator, but I would say the leaders that, you know, I was placed under was more welcoming to me, more welcoming, wanted me to continue advancing because, once again, I'm intrinsically motivated to always better myself. So when I was in North Carolina, I finished my doctoral degree. I was coming across different school leaders who didn't have it, and that's your prerogative. But in coming to New York City, it's just, you know, I was placed under leaders that wanted me to continue in education as far as going into leadership, which I already had all of those licenses already. So now I'm in a capacity where I'm working in a high school, first time ever, but this is a special district. I work for District 75. District 75 is placed all around New York City, but it's for students that have learning disabilities, more special needs. So I'm in a high school. It's 7 through 12, even though the kids are, you know, their age match their grade level. Academically, they're not there. They're alternatively assessed. So this is a different capacity because now it's about students are still learning, but they are learning more work skills, job skills, life skills to help them be able to go outside and function different from, you know, college and career. Because the students at my school, they're not going to get a diploma. So it's not an academic track or college and career ready. So, I mean, it's still an eye-opener for me because I've always worked in general educational inclusion. But it's a blessing to be under, you know, the leadership of people that doesn't look at their job as a job, but really taking care of the students, having programs for them, keeping them active. And I think the change and the shift as far as being here for the pandemic, everything, it should have been a big focus, mental health and social emotional learning. I think that's the biggest shift for me because before the pandemic, you know, we knew those, you know, people need counseling and people have behavioral issues. But I think the pandemic just highlighted a little more because people were closed in or scared or sheltered in their homes. And then some people experienced a lot of loss, a lot of grief as well. So I hope, I don't want to take you through the whole long story, but, yeah, those are the different shifts from then to now.
Now, say a little bit more about the mental health component. Did you have to build that into the school system, or was the existing one there that was there, was it sufficient to meet the needs of those students?
Yeah, so coming to New York City, I got here, let's see, probably like July 2019. So that first experience, you know, it was life as normal, right? We call it life as normal. The following year, 2020 March, is when the pandemic hit. So that was really interesting because everybody was home. I was working online. I lost a lot of my students as far as some people left out of town, some people didn't log in because everything was computer-based. So I think it doesn't matter if you were 30 years to 5 years in the school system, that was a shift for everybody, unless you had experience teaching online already. As far as elementary school, how we know it, elementary, high school, that was just a difference of being online. Students not able to be with their peers, some parents, families scared. So it was a big shift for everybody. I said that everybody starts brand new. And they started to embed social-emotional learning check-ins throughout the day. So in that school, that I, particular school that I was at in the beginning, they would call, like, use 10 minutes of the class in the beginning or the end for just SEL moments. When I hear my principal talking now, because I was working in the Bronx when I first came here, stayed there for 2 years. And then after the third year, I went into a school in Brooklyn, and that's where they were inviting everybody back to school. So they would do a lot of check-ins, ask everybody how they were doing, more off of the academics. And this school that I'm at now, it's different because it's not all about test scores. It's not the pressures of, like, of course you want your students to learn and meet their IEP goals because they are, you know, they were diagnosed. They have a learning disability, whether it's autism. Our students have something. So you want to see their growth. You're checking for that. But also there's the counselor's piece. So it's embedded in the schedule. On this school that I'm at now, some students are seeing outside counselors for whatever reason, but they have a doctor's diagnosis. So I think now people are more sensitive of, you know, students' well-being. But more than ever, you're hearing the different stories. I think the last story was a six-year-old who shot his or her teacher in a school. I think that was in Virginia. So,
yes.
Yeah, so more than ever, it's, you know, noticing, you know, are you okay? You know, answering those questions, not like, okay, why are you off task? But really, I think all of us have to be sensitive to ask students now, hey, are you okay? Those sidebar conversations to check in and see how they're doing, because they may not know how to cope with the things that's happening externally.
Yeah, that's what my concern was, listening to you. There are these young people that are starting out below the line, and it seemed like it would be an even greater challenge for them. And then again, it might not be compared to a student in a regular class. I was just thinking, that was just ran through my mind, that the student in a regular class might be under more stress than the student in the class where you are, because it's not pursuing the academic, there's not academic goals. You're preparing them for the workplace. And the work that they are doing is, I hate to use the term, it's not below par, but it's at a level that where they can function at. I guess that's the best way of putting it. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I agree. And it's just a different world for me because I'm coming from, you know, 17, 18 years of being at schools where, you know, if the pressure is on you as an educator because you want to meet the needs of your learners, whether it's you're teaching reading, you're teaching science, you're teaching math, you want to make sure that they're functioning for the test. Even though people are saying, oh, well, you don't teach to the test, reality is as an educator, you want your students to shine. And then when your students shine, that's under your name. If you're teaching them and you're in a tested area subject. So coming out of that, I am spanking new into a high school, that's one, but also into this arena where students are on the spectrum, autism. They have learning disabilities. There are students there that are on wheelchairs. They're nonverbal. There are students, you know, that are in wheelchairs, but they are verbal. So, it doesn't matter if a student is in a regular ed or they are in, schools like the one that I'm in, like specialized instruction. It's important to teach children and even adults how to cope with stress because there are adults that are going through issues as well, right? So everyone mm-hmm. needs to know how to communicate and know how to express themselves if they're experiencing issues, you know, express themselves appropriately. I wouldn't say it's one over the other one. I wouldn't put one over the other one. I think that is an important skill for us as adults and children to learn, you know, when I'm frustrated, do this. Or when I need help, you know, this is what I do. Because in the capacity where I'm working, a child may be liable to punch a teacher, slap a teacher, kick a teacher. And if you're, you know, it's like, man, you want to take it personal, but you have to remember that these are the manifestations of a child's behavior. A lot of our children are crying out for help. I do believe some students understand what they're doing. They might throw everybody else's things, but they're not throwing their personal things. So they have their own sense. But I just think we all just need to be sensitive, no matter where we are, if it's education or the regular workplace or whoever, you know, anyone that we have relationships with, we have to be mindful of how we're expressing ourselves. That's a skill we all need on communication and how to express ourselves appropriately, not hurting anyone's feelings, because it's not what you say, it's how you say it.
Host Cunningham, do you have a question or comment? I don't want to seem like I'm hogging the whole.
I do not. But Apostle, you're from the educational background. That's not my background, so you know what type questions to ask. So it's just amazing what I'm hearing, though. I'm just enjoying the conversation from Dr. Babb. Am I correct?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure. So I'm enjoying the discussion and her explanations of everything. It's just, it's, you know, to hear it from the inside of somebody that's inside and personal with it, mm-hmm. you know. So you're asking the questions. You're familiar with that zone. So I'm just enjoying what I'm hearing.
All right. One of the mm-hmm. reasons I'm going down that path, I have a third cousin that is differently able, and that's what we're calling them. We started that in 1988, whenever we conned that at one of the meetings that we had when I was in the United Methodist denomination, and we had a workshop, and we were discussing handicap and all those different labels that people, that society impose upon people who they define as being different. So we kicked it around, and we came up with the term differently able. That make more sense than telling somebody you're handicapped. Handicap is a negative label, because it means hand eye cap. You got, whenever I think of that term, I think of a person that has his hat in his hand holding out, looking for a handout. But whenever I look at someone that are differently able, that tells me that's a positive label, And that tells me that that person is still capable of doing things. It's just different from the norm. And that's what I was thinking about as I was listening to you and thinking about my cousin who graduated. Do y'all call it graduation? Hello?
Are you talking to me?
Tell me,
Apostle?
Me? Yeah. Yeah, do y'all call it graduation?
Yeah, so they still have their, you know, promotional ceremony or graduation, yes. However, they're not going to get a diploma. They might get a certificate, but it's not academically based.
Right.
So they're not going to get
finished,
a diploma.
He completed his and his training for employment, and I forgot where he's working. So to me, I thought that was great because in the past, they were just left sitting in a corner someplace. But now we see that everybody has a value and there is no negative in when we're looking at people now. And the guy that's just cleaning the place, well, to me, that's the most important person that's working there. Because if the place is not clean, then there's all kinds of germs and everything floating around. So we should have the same level of respect for him as you have for the president of the corporation. Is that what, whenever you prepare the young people for employment, do you sort of look at it that way and sort of instill those type of values and mores in them? Or do you just say you're preparing them for a job?
Right. I totally agree with you, Bishop Armstrong. I totally agree with you. And like I said, this is just not limited to the education, workplace. It's with everything, because how many of you ever been to a store and the person doesn't have the best customer service skills? You're going to look for an item to wear and you didn't get greeted, or you're being profiled. They're, you know, more looking to see if you're going to steal something, or instead of saying hello, you know, can I help you with anything? I just think it's whether you have, you know, I always say, because, we, you know, you have to be careful. Yes, calling somebody handicapped. There are words that are just, you know, that was back in the day. Now it's like a learning disability. Mm-hmm. Because I always say we all have something, whether it's diagnosed or not. We all have something that we need to work on. I think that is very important to teach people customer service, like, you know, just appropriateness. Yeah, I've been in stores where instead of somebody saying, good morning, how can I help you? They don't say that. Hello? Or somebody walk into where you are and they don't address you. I think it's just basic common sense things that we have to bring back and teach people. It's not just about young people. There are older folks who should know better that don't know.
That's so true. You made me think about situations where when you walk into a store and then you're not befriended or welcomed, and then the person in behind you, it's like because of the color of their skin or whatever, they immediately say, how can I help you? And I'm like, I've been in situations like that, and because of that, I've kind of walked out. I'm like, okay, my money spends anywhere, but I won't spend it here. I've done that
right
before. And because I'm like, if you can't respect me enough to be in your store, and some of them have been like small businesses. And when you go in there, and if you're like, that's just happened to me recently. So I just say, okay. I have the money to spend, but I won't support your store. You couldn't even greet me, but you greet the person in behind me. So Yes, mm-hmm. that's right. You don't know if that's how they were raised or if they just, you know, if you know, and they're dealing with that because of that, or, you know, I don't have time to even waste any brain cells on it. I just say, okay, well, I'll spend my money somewhere else where I'm appreciated. So I'll just walk on out the store. But that makes sense. And then, too, I was reminded of my cousin. She's a few years older than I am. She's in her 60s, but she's a few years older than I am. And she was born with what is called Down syndrome. But when she was younger, when she was working, she would work at this place they call Gaston Skills in Gastonia. And they allowed them to go to work. I mean, she was excited. She was excited to be able to go to work, and I think she worked on like an assembly line, and they put things together, and she was just like, I got to go work tomorrow. No, I'm not, you know. So she was excited to be able to be used, and we didn't look at her like that. We knew that she had challenges when we were younger and coming up, but we didn't look at it. And then later on you get the, you know, as you get older, you start understanding, okay, well, that's what she has dealt with. She was born that way with that, but it didn't stop her. She's still thriving. She's still going and doing, and she's outlived some of my other cousins, but she's just still the happy-go-lucky lady that she was when we were little. And when you mentioned that about the term that you use, how was that? What was that you called it? I like that.
Differently able. Differently able.
Differently able. Differently abled. I like that. But we didn't ever pick with her or anything. I never seen any of my other cousins or my brothers. Nobody picked at her or anything. Actually, we kind of stood up for her. So just to hear you, you know, talk about that arena as well, to bring that part of it up with the challenges of the students you work with, everybody has something to bring to the table. And like you said, everybody has something that they're dealing with. So it's just a blessing to hear that.
Now, this is just want to get your reaction. Some of these young people who were home during the pandemic, and they found out in terms of their parents they found out that their relationship between them and their parents wasn't what they had expected to be or thought it was, and it might not have been anything, but the way that it went down, the parents was trying to push them out. Some of the children probably felt like the parents were trying to get rid of them. They wanted them to go to school, and regardless of what was out there, and the students were fearful. Some were fearful. Yeah, they wanted to be with their peers, but they was fearful based on what they was hearing about the pandemic. The teachers have any type of discussion around that?
You said if teachers discuss about students being afraid?
Yeah, did the teachers understand some of the dynamics that was going on in the home that these children was coming out of? And that was why they really wanted to be in the classroom. They weren't so much they wanted to be in the classroom, but they felt that being with their peers meant more to them than being home with their parents.
Of course, yes. I think as an educator, I think a lot of us went through the emotions. For example, it's like you don't want to put yourself in harm's way, you know, especially if you're living with young children or you're living with, you know, your parents, you know, someone older than you. So it was scary for educators. When we did finally went remote, it was tough because now you're not seeing your students. You're struggling to see what exercises you could do, what activities you could do that could still kind of continue the curriculum or review. And then when the school year opened up, there were some that were on campus, but I was able to be home. So, you know, when you look at it, it was convenient to be home, but you were not meeting all of your students. So, yeah, you know, and it was issues for parents because, of course, some parents continued to work. They couldn't stay home, so they had their children home. At that time, I was volunteering at a, they were calling it essential workers, and I would work at a school, and then they would have students coming in there and doing programs with them because those are the essential workers who, of course, their kids can't stay home. So it wasn't just a battle, and everybody says it, that was a two-year loss for students because of the pandemic and them not being in school. So, but it worked for some, you know, but majority of the students took a loss all over of just being home and not getting the support that they needed for school. So it posed, you know,
yeah.
It had its benefits, but there were negative, you know, some students took a loss in their studies because of them being home and not having, you know, not being with their peers and not getting the hands-on in front of you instruction. So.
Yeah, I knew that was a lot of discussion was taking place regarding that. And they were saying that the students, they lost time. Not physical time, but intellectual education time, that they didn't know how they're going to make that up. So is that still part of the discussion now?
Yeah, so Frank, I just really started my position last year, August. But coming back to work, this was 2023. Okay, so 2021 school year, the school that I was, I had sixth graders, and we noticed that, like, this is them coming, like, this is when they hurried up and forced a lot of us to get the vaccines in order to come back into the building, and the students are getting acclimated to having a full 5 days of school in person. So they said that these are the students that took a loss because their fourth grade school year, so when in the pandemic, fifth grade was a wash because they were home. So I just, as an educator, you kind of slow down. You know, we had the autonomy to slow down our curriculum and went into basic skills. I was a reading teacher. So basic skills of reading and writing and still letting them know, you know, how to answer questions effectively because you essentially prepping them for the state test. They didn't exempt the state test 2021-22 school year. But collectively, all of the ELA teachers, I was six, there was a seventh grade teacher, eighth grade teacher, our students at our school shine in language arts for reading. But it was still holding them accountable and, you know, doing the exercises with them. So, you know, that was good for the school. I don't know what's going to happen this year. I'm not there. But all around, even in the new setting that I'm in, the principal mentioned that the school community took a loss because people went through grief. Some people lost so many family members. They had a couple of staff members that passed away during the pandemic. So this would always go down in the history books, you know? Yeah,
and I can imagine what the students were going through whenever they went back and they found out that the pandemic was real and they had to hit them square in the face. And whenever I say it was real, they probably heard a lot of these conspiracy theories and all this foolishness, and they saw for themselves whenever they arrived back and their teacher wasn't there that they knew and that they loved, that they cared for, And it turns out that that teacher wound up succumbing to the pandemic. Because I remember all of that stuff that they were talking about that was happening in New York with during the pandemic, and how, and I can just imagine how frightening it was for them when they were making those makeshift morgues and all of that. And poor kids are sitting there listening to that or watching that or hearing about that. And then they had to go out, not only in the school, they found that there was that impact, but maybe that corner store, that they stopped that. That, you know, somebody might have had COVID there. And so I just can imagine that it was a very stressful time, even outside of the school, even though they were not there. And they still was not around somebody that could help them deal with the stress the way teachers help you whenever you're going through stressful things in your community. Well,
yeah, you're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was saying that you're absolutely right. Living in New York, especially during the pandemic, I think I had more friends than anything would contact me to see, how's everybody doing? Are you okay? Because you just think of New York as this big saturated place. And
mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, and the joke, all the jokes that's told is like, yeah, you know, if you lived in New York, you have COVID, you got COVID. Everybody would, you know, make jokes and say it. But it's absolutely right, especially in Manhattan. A lot of people were moving from, you know, New York City and like the dense, more populated places to go and live further out in the suburbs, or, you know, buy houses and get out of there because everything is so expensive, just because, you know, it was running rampant and it's still around. But, you know, that summer I went to, you know, North Carolina, and you would see different things on TV, Atlanta. I think southern states were just moving like nothing. But places like New York City, during the heart of the pandemic times, was very, it was like a ghost town. Definitely like a ghost town.
Yeah, I know a lot of the people who could afford it, they were saying they were moving to Florida. And in a place where there was open space. And now, did that have an impact on the budget, the school budget?
You know, that's a great question. And, you know, during that time of my career, I didn't really have, like, access and I didn't know anything about the budget. However, starting
mm-hmm.
the school year, they were going through, like, budget cuts because it was just overall just less students. So you would hear of them saying, oh, we don't know if teachers are going to continue or this class is full. So you did hear of those things. But I, you know, thank God I didn't experience that. But you did hear the buzz of, you know, we have to get funding. And this has to be funded. So that's a good question. Apostle, that's a good question.
All right. I was just sitting here. What impact do you think it had on black males? Maybe let me ask another. The pandemic, yes. Black male students.
That is something great to actually research.
yeah.
You know, that's a tough one. I you know, and when the pandemic hit, those first 2 years I was working in the Bronx. So the demographics of my students, they were majority of, you know, majority were Latino students, Hispanics.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have a lot of black students. Going to Brooklyn, there were more black students there. This is not after the pandemic, but this is when they started to make the mandates for teachers to be vaccinated and going back, you know, going back into the building. So this, the demographics of that school is majority black. But the impact, that is an awesome question for further research.
Reason I'm raising that question, and this is my theory, that the school system was not set up to educate black males. If we look at it historically, in an agriculture-type economy, males were the one, the backbone of that economy. And the more black males, the more males you had, the better off you were because they could be out working in the fields. And so who went to school? It was the females. They were the ones that had the opportunity to go to school. And because they won't need it in the field as early as the male. And then most of them were there harvest time, or they might have had to stay out to take care of the, if they had smaller siblings, they would have to stay out to take care of them. And that was one of the reasons I was just raising that. And because growing up, there will only be four people in my class for years in elementary school. And the three of us was there because our people owned land. And the fourth person was there because her grandparents, and they worked in the big house. So she didn't have to worry about being out in the field. And now if we fast forward it to the machine age, what did they do then? They had got rid of those jobs on the farm and they pushed them into the cities. And the alternative then, or you could go to the military. So that meant that there was, like now you have the pipeline from school to prison. Back then you had the pipeline from school to the military. And then under Ronald Reagan, he raised the education level. And then you start seeing these young boys out there on the corner because the school system was not embracing them. They will expel them and all that, suspend them and all that. And here was another layer that was laid on them. That's what was behind the question that I raised. Is there any truth in that?
Yeah, I've heard that before. The education system, especially for black and brown students, are not designed, you know, for them to excel. But Bishop, you just enlightened me because you talked about, you know, the pipeline to the military, right? But you hear of, you know, black and brown pipeline to prison. So it's very important, you know, when we look at our curriculum that we're helping out, you know, it's building awareness, but we're also helping students see beyond where they live, you know. Because some students, they don't even come out of their neighborhood. They just are within their, they only know what they know about their neighborhood. So I think as a whole, when we look at the educational system, it just needs revamping so we can expose students to other things, other communities, other places. And with the hands of the internet, Google, you know, is definitely within reach. But it's just knowing how to implement those things in your instruction and how to, you know, just the how to get there. You know, even with this population that I'm serving in now, you know, there are students that just do the right thing, and then there are students that they are the so-called bad boys, bad girls of the school. And it's having those conversations with them, like, hey, you know, you can't just put your hands on someone, or no, you can't bring alcohol in the school, or you can't vape in school. So you'll be amazed, you know, the things that's happening.
I don't think I will be because I work with the young people there in Baltimore, on the east side of Baltimore, Iowa, where it's called a war zone, and they were out of the education system because a lot of them got suspended, and after you're suspended and you stay out there for a while, you wind up behind, and what do you do then? You drop out. So the dropout rate was real high, and they would be on the corner. And I related to them because I didn't go out there condemning them. I called them pharmaceutical specialists. Pharmacists, that's what a pharmacist does. He pushes drugs. He or she pushes drugs. That's their profession. That's what they're trained to do. So by calling them that was a positive. They saw that I made a positive statement about what they were doing, and we could have a conversation about it. But the jobs, the low pay, the skilled type jobs, whenever they vanished in America, that's whenever we start seeing black males standing on the corner. Females, they were able to go and get their education, whereas the males, they couldn't. And part of it had to do with the fact that they were not academically prepared. And everybody couldn't play sports. And even those who played sports, they never gotten a degree, because half of them couldn't read anyway, because they was passed because they were good image for the school. And I don't know what you can do to help these young men, but that's the reality that I had to face whenever I was out there. And I was also the school police chaplain, and the mayor and the head of the school police, they were in conflict. The mayor said, violate the young boys and lock them up. The school police chief, his whole thing was, that's not what we're about. We are to make sure that the young people have a safe, comfortable place to get their education. So here that pipeline to prison came out of the mayor's office. He contributed to that there in Baltimore City. What can we do outside of the school system? I think we as a community need to step up to the plate.
Yeah, I agree with you. And, you know, everybody thinks that, you know, it's not a one size fits all method. Everybody just can't bank on the schools because the students go home. So I think it needs to be a community approach, as parents, all stakeholders involved. I always said, even as a female teacher, my students, all colors, had respect for me. I always had a good rapport with my students, but sometimes, you know, especially when I'm looking at, and I'm a mom of girls, but a lot of my male boys are, you know, a lot of them were in single mother, you know, single parent homes. Their mother was raising them, or grandmother. So me talking to them is just another, you know, or my mom speaking, you know, is my mother speaking to me. So I always thought, and maybe I'm, you know, I don't know, I always say we need strong males to direct our young students of, you know, how to, you know, be men and protect and be, want to know how to read, want to be successful in your education, because that's another, you know, that's a male, someone that they can relate to. I'm a female. So that's how I always, that's why I admired. One thing that I recognized in the working in the beginning of the school year at the school in Brooklyn is that principal, he's a black male, but he also had a lot of males in the school in the very beginning of 2021. So that first 2 months, you would see a lot of males in the hallway. It was a lot of males in the building, and I thought that was a strong look for the school, just strong males, period, to let the students know, okay, we have support. I don't know, you know, what was his thoughts behind that. And then I remember seeing not a commercial, but it was one of those things floating on social media about a school in New Orleans that had, they called it like the Brotherhood, and it was a lot of men outside, and they would go through the school. They were Greek students, and they were at a high school. You know, they're men of color. Mm. Greet the students in the morning, be in the hallways, be there, you know, going through the classes. And that decreased the behavior infractions just because of their presence. So I think things like that, and, of course, the community coming together, parents being a support, not fighting the teachers or, you know, going against, but everybody working together of keeping the children in mind to better them so they can have a better future. It takes, you know, it's so true when they say it takes a village. But I don't know, it would be great to have that where everybody is looking after each other. It's not of, you know, once I'm home, I'm closing my door and I'm minding my business, but community, everybody coming together to better our community, to better our future, which is our kids.
Yeah, you may hit on another topic there. Is these parents. I ran a youth group we call Youth Solution, where the young people, they were the ones that came together. So one day, one of the young persons in that group, he was very belligerent and he didn't want to follow the rules, and they created the rules. And he had to take this the way I meant it. I told him, look, I am not going to hit you with my prosthesis on. He said, but I'll take you out back and whip your butt. And then I'm going to take you and we're going to go home. I'm going to whip your parents. And the thing about it was that type of language that he understood. And he also understood that I am not afraid of his parents, him going home, telling his parents, and his parents come down there. So you're right. They do have a tendency to take advantage of the ladies. And now, y'all can jump on me if y'all want. That's fine. I'm thick-skinned. I can handle it. I think that women also can do more. And I think women can have an influence. I'm not saying teach. I'm saying have an influence on how a young male needs to act and how that young male needed to relate to females by that mother's relationship that she has with her friend. Children have a tendency to do what they see. And that's just me. That's my take on it. I think it's a double whammy. And I'm not saying, now don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that the total it's on the female, but I think they have a role to play in that process as well, and they're not playing it. It's like, I have a man, that's my man. My man can do whatever he wants. My man comes over when he gets ready. My man sort of pushes me around. All of that kind of stuff, that's not teaching the male, her son or her daughter, how they should act in a male-female relationship. Why are we real quiet now?
We're listening to you.
All right, Sister Cunningham, what's your take?
On the comment you just made, or what?
Yes. Yes, the comments that I just made.
I mean, I raised my sons they're very respectable young men. So I kind of, by the way I live, I showed them how to treat a woman, how they saw me live and how they saw me be treated. So, I taught them how to respect a woman, open the door for her. To this day, they still do that. They open the doors for their wives. And so, and that kind of, they do that. So I don't know. I just kind of taught them, this is what you do, and this is, you don't do that. And I just kind of taught them that way. And they still honor that, the teaching. So I'm grateful for that. They didn't give me a damn trouble. I don't know what else to say. Is that what you're kind of saying? I don't know.
Yeah, but that's basically what I was saying. I think society itself has dumbed down the relationship, just like what we see now with the Republican Party. That was dumbed down with Rush Limbaugh and all them telling people that they can't think for themselves. Somebody got to think for them. And you come to me, I'll tell you what to think, how to think, and all of that. And I think that's similar to what's happening in the family nowadays. And nobody really, I'll put it this way. We told our children whenever they got to be teenagers, we sit them down one day and said, look, if we've done anything to offend you, we're sorry. Nobody gave us a book or class on how to raise children. So
that's right.
We did the best we could with what we had. Now, and that was the way we left it. It was up to them at that point to make their little comments, and nobody said anything, we didn't bully them into being quiet either.
Yeah.
Well, I think that our time probably is, we do have a few more minutes, but I think that's one of the things that gets played out in this society too much. I think that if we focus on something else other than that, here now, you got the psychologists, you got the psychiatrists, you got the lawyers, you got the doctors. Everybody want to blame somebody. They're playing what I call the blame game, name blame game. Well, it was my father. It was my mama. It was because I didn't have a daddy. Well, there was a lot of people that didn't have a daddy when I was growing up, but they had an uncle, and they had a community daddy. You could tell the young people, you can't do this, or you could just about give them a spanking out there in the street. And when they got home, they got another one. So that's part of the problem. And my people were held accountable for my behavior. And society, all of a sudden, that changed. Now, young people do whatever they want, and their parents can be standing there. And society looks to the young people. And that's why I say the pipeline to prison, that they, especially juvenile, they got built all these juvenile prisons and stuff. So don't get me started, because I say that we can educate children cheaper than we can lock them up, and they wind up becoming productive member of society as opposed to being dependent. And I cannot see.
No, I was letting
you
finish it. Did I? Yeah, I was saying, Bishop Armstrong, that, you know, some of my students, we kind of look at them because some of them are so resistant to learning, you know, want to do their own thing, and they want to go, you know, and for me as the adult in my head, I'm thinking, well, you know, in life, you have to listen to somebody. So if you have a problem listening to authority, if you have a problem in, you know, being respectful, then, you know, then I can see how, you know, people taking that bad attitude, and then later on, if they keep those things up, having problems with law enforcement. Because it goes back to, once again, communication and knowing order and knowing how to speak to people, right? Some students, you question where it comes from. You question, you know, is it from home? Where are they learning these things from? And you try to teach them, well, life skills. Okay, you have to be respectful. You know, you have to treat people with kindness. No one's saying, you know, you to be a pushover. No, you stand up for yourself, but there's a time and a place. So as an educator, I always held my students accountable. My highest grade that I taught was 8th grade, but I didn't, you know, any bullying, fighting, you know, attitude. I didn't, you know, I would tell students what it is, because you can't, I believe it's my job as an educator to not just teach students about math, but also teach them how to communicate, teach them those things that they need to know when they're walking on the street, that they, you know, to avoid getting into issues or conflict with people.
Yeah, and your point that you made also, words have feelings. It's not what you say. It is what the person who receives them, how that makes them feel. If it makes them feel comfortable with you, then you can engage them in a dialogue. If what you're saying generate feeling of animosity and hatred and all that, then bam, you lost the battle. No point in you even going down that road until you can figure out how you can bring about a change in that person's attitude and what that person feels. And we don't get a whole lot of opportunity to have do things that cause people to change. The old people used to say the first impression is the most important impression. And so the first words we say, it generates feelings. Like whenever I challenged that young man, that generated a feeling in him to let him know that he can't push me around. So he went back to that feeling, and he realized, well, now I'm going to have to figure out another way. Yeah, we have these rules. Maybe if I follow the rules. And the young man, I got to find out if he graduated. He went to Morgan. Same young man. He went to Morgan State University there in Baltimore. And his brother became an electrician. It's sometimes we have to read people and see what it is, as we used to say, what makes them tick, and look at it and see what makes that person tick. And just like what you were saying, you gave them the type of skills that they needed when they were walking the street, which didn't have anything to do with that learning, that the skills for that job, but it did. In a way, you're teaching them how to communicate, that body language. You're walking down the street, and you know that if you carry yourself in a certain way, you're asking somebody to jump you. So you have to be able to adapt to various situations and circumstances so that you can protect yourself. So words do have not only meaning, but words have feelings, because they generate feelings. All right. It is now, should be around 7 o'clock. And since we only have one guest, we can call it a night. If you guys don't have anything else that you would like to put on the table.
Well, once again, thank you, Bishop Armstrong, for inviting me to be on your show this evening. Ms. Cunningham, nice speaking to you. And I appreciate the topic that we talked about tonight.
All right, Ms. Cunningham, would you like to have the last word?
Yes, I just wanted to say, yes, it was nice meeting you, Dr. Babb, and hearing the conversation and just being here to be a part of it. That last part that came out about the children and the disrespect just reminded me of an incident I experienced yesterday in Walmart. I just went in to get one item, and as I was coming, got my item and was coming to the checkout, the store was pretty crowded, but there was this gentleman and I believe she was his daughter. She was almost as tall as him, but they were just arguing, and she was weaving in and out of the aisles at the edge close to the register. She was going back and forth, and I was like, what is going on? As I was approaching them, and they was arguing. I mean, and she was just arguing right back with him, and I'm like, where's the respect? And it was like he wasn't giving her any, and she definitely wasn't giving – well, let me say, she definitely wasn't giving him any respect, and he wasn't giving her any, and people were just like, just trying to figure out, make sure we okay here, or am I okay? And I just began to pray under my breath. And then when I looked at her, she gave me eye contact. I smiled at her, and she just completely stopped saying anything. So I was grateful for that. You know, something just stopped her in her tracks. So she just shut up. She didn't say any more, and he was still going. So then they went on out the door. So I was like, you know, with this younger generation, the respect is just out the door. You don't know, like you shared, you don't know what they're experiencing at home. You don't know what causes them to act these type ways. That's all they know. They don't know they hadn't been taught anything. They hadn't, you know, been taught anything else, and all they, maybe that's all she knows is to argue back, but I don't know. It was just so very distractive because everybody was saw it, and it was just, it was hurt, you know, disheartening to see because they were people of color, of course, and you know, so it was just you know, disheartening. But I was glad to be a part of the call, and good to meet you as well. Thank you, Apostle.
Well, so those were the last words, and we will be back next week at 6 p.m. on Sunday, and the person that will be one of them right now that I know, he will be a professional indoor soccer player. Well, now we say ex, because they no longer have indoor soccer anymore. And he will be talking about his experience there from 1975 to present. And hopefully we will have another guest there. We may have a female there as well. So until then, everyone, may the divine spirit bless and keep you until, not just until next week, but bless and keep you forever. Shalom, shalom, shalom.
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 All right.